I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Friday, February 22nd. The time is 3:35 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Dyson, Senators McGuire, Senator Faircloth, Senator Bishop, Senator Michicki, and myself, Senator Giesel. Senator French has an excused absence today. He may be calling in at some point, but Betsy will let us know if he signs on. So, today we will, just a reminder, the committee time is extended until 5:30. So starting off, I'd like to bring a blank committee substitute for Senate Bill 21 to the table today. But before we do that, I want to speak to the process. The committee substitute incorporates concepts that were brought forward by the TAPS Throughput Committee in their letter of intent, individual members of this committee, and testimony from stakeholders, including the public. Some of the ideas that we've heard have been incorporated, some have not. We'll be hearing from all members of the committee on those features that they offered and that you will find in the CS today. Sponsors of ideas that did not appear in the CS will be asked to introduce any they still wish to include at the conclusion of this initial discussion. So we will hear additional amendments ongoing here. A packet of some of those additional amendments that have been submitted are distributed to the committee members today. You have them in your packet. So, Vice Chairman Dyson, do I hear a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt blank CS for Senate Bill 21 version /U, work draft.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. I'll object for purposes of discussion. So, my staff, Sharon Long, is at the testimony table, and she's going to describe the changes to Senate Bill 21. Specific committee members who offered those concepts will speak to those features. And then we have consultants here who will flesh out the details of some of the items in the CS, as well as legislative legal services attorneys who are present. We also have representatives from the administration, Department of Natural Resources, Revenue, and Law, are here to respond to certain elements and questions that might come up. So, in terms of elements that were brought forward, either in the letter of intent or by individual members, we're going to start out with a concept that addresses the government take at high prices and at low prices. And just for labeling, we call it the 35-5 element. Ms. Long, would you please help the committee in locating that change to the CS?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the Resources Committee. My name is Sharon Long, and I'm staff to Senator Taffy Giesel. The provision that flattens the government take line starts on page 4. And you will see right there at the top of the page on line 1 that it changes the base tax rate from 25 to 35%. It adds a $5 per taxable barrel credit for North Slope production. That credit is not transferable. It cannot be carried forward. It must be used against the tax liability for the year in which the barrel was produced. And it cannot be used to reduce the tax below zero in any given year. And Madam Chair, you had asked this to be modeled by our consultant. This requirement in the bill is going to require the industry to in order to get this, I move to the next item here. Anyway, we have this modeled, and Mr. Mayor with PFC Energy is here if you wish to have him present his slides.
That would be great. Mr. Mayor, if you'd come forward. But while he's coming forward, I want to take committee members to page 18 of the bill. It's section 18, which begins on line 14. Lots of numbers. So I'll wait till you get to page 18. You see section 18 on line 14. And second on line 15, it says, a producer may apply a tax credit of $5 for each barrel of taxable oil produced during a calendar year. So, in summary, the suggested change to the bill raises the flat tax rate to 35%, and you see that first noted on page 4 of the bill, and it's mentioned several other times throughout the bill on page 7, line 28. All of these are just to make uniformity throughout the bill. Line 8, or page 8, line 12, and also line 26. On page 9 of the bill, line 5. And then the $5 credit for each produced taxable oil barrel on page 18. So we asked PFC, our consultant for the legislature, to give us an idea of what this will look like. The idea was brought forward by Senator Machicki, and after we see the modeling, I think Senator Machicki probably wants to speak to the intent of this. So, Mr. Mayor, would you like to present the modeling for this?
Madam Chair, certainly. Bring this microphone forward. Just to put myself on the record, Janik Mayer, PFC Energy manager in our upstream practice and project manager of our engagement here with the Alaska State Legislature. Madam Chair, I imagine a significant part of the impetus for this comes from some of the work we've seen so far. This slide, for instance, in front of you, which I presented before this committee last week, in terms of concerns that the bill as it has stood up until now, while it is certainly a tax decrease at high oil prices, there comes a crossover point at which, below which, because of the removal of the capital credit, essentially represents a tax increase rather than a decrease. And as the slide shows, the question of the exact price at which that occurs depends a lot on one's assumptions about levels of capital spending. And so a producer with low levels of capital spending might see that crossover occur only at a sort of $70 to $80 price range. Certainly that would be the case if we look just at the large mature producing fields and nothing else. But if we also incorporate new spending that's going on and have a higher CapEx number that we're using, what we see is that the price level at which this is in fact a tax increase rather than a decrease steadily rises. So for someone with capital expenditures of say $20-$25 a barrel, that price level is really somewhere more like current oil prices, $100-$110 range. So if we, and to come and put this in context as well of sort of overall regime competitiveness, I've presented a number of times before sort of series of bar charts of what the Alaska regime looks like at $60, $80, $100, etc. This essentially is the same thing, looking at ACEs in the green line and how that compares with some of the averages of those other regimes to sort of simplify and distill this. And what we see, of course, is that while it starts off reasonably competitive at $60 a barrel, by 100 or so, it's already up at the average, not only of other regimes, but in fact up at the average of production sharing contract regimes, which tend to be some of the highest government take contracts around, versus, for instance, the average for royalty regimes, which is down at 60, and the average for all OECD countries, which is down in the high 50s. And it gets steadily more the case. Senate Bill 21, by contrast, as you can see, again, has that crossover where below around, in this case, again, around $75-$80 a barrel, based on assumptions that are about purely base production, not the higher capital that comes from new development. From that point on, it represents a steady reduction in government take, but again, below that point, it's in fact a tax increase.
Mr. Janik, just for clarity, so SB 21, as it is currently written, not this committee substitute,
indeed,
is the dark blue line, am I correct?
That's correct, ma'am.
That has a downward slope and then levels off above that yellow line.
That is correct. That is correct. Okay. That yellow line being the average for royalty regimes around the world.
And what is the lighter blue line? I can't read the tiny writing on there.
That's the average for production sharing contract regimes around the world.
All right. Thank you.
Yes. As you can see, there are two fundamental issues. One being concerns being raised with the regressive nature of SB 21 as it currently stands. That is, that the government take steadily falls, particularly earlier in the price deck, and then flattens off. And then the question of that crossover and how to address that. So it seems to me that those are two of the key things that are trying to be addressed here by introducing a different form of tax credit rather than being one tied to spending and capital development, one that's tied to production. And there are strengths and weaknesses of that approach, as we'll see. This slide and assumptions applies to other regimes that were requested for modelling rather than the CS, so we can skip over that. These charts are busier than they might otherwise have to be for the fact that they also compare a number of other possible regime interventions that were asked to be looked at. But in the red, what we see is ACEs. In the yellow, again, Senate Bill 21. Again, what we see is exactly the same as what we saw in the previous chart, just more granular. But that same rising government take for ACEs and falling government take from sort of 66% at $70 a barrel down to just under 62% at $150 a barrel of Senate Bill 21. The purple is what you get when you look at the fundamentals of the CS in terms of raising the base rate to 35% but introducing a $5 a barrel production credit per taxable barrel produced, only claimable in that year. So what you see is instead a much flatter overall level of government take, again, when one does this using the assumptions of a base producer and solely looking at the cost component in that sense that comes from mature producing fields at Prudhoe Bay, as it were, rather than additional capital that's being incurred in satellites, Point Thompson, elsewhere. But a much flatter level of government take at sort of around the 65% mark and taking that crossover point from, in this case, about $75 a barrel down to $70 a barrel, though again, that will be somewhat sensitive on cost assumptions, as we'll see in some of the future slides. On the right, I've also shown what this looks like if we look not only at undiscounted government take, i.e. treating government take across all the periods as being equal, but instead discounted government take, so taking the discounted cash flows of government take and what that looks like. And what you see is that at least when we're looking at base production, those are fairly comparable. Where that changes, though, is when we look at a new development on a standalone basis. So this is, for a new development, this is meaning a new development outside an existing producing area, including the gross revenue exclusion. In this case, for instance, on the left, what we see is a slightly higher level, as you'd expect, of government take under the CS with the 35% base and the $5 a barrel per taxable barrel production credit. Slightly flatter, though, again, though when what one is looking at is a new development rather than base production, that impact is less evident because it does once again become slightly regressive. But it's ultimately what's lowering government take in this case is not any of the fundamentals of either the base rate, the production credit, but overwhelmingly what keeps government take here substantially below ACEs is the impact of the gross revenue exclusion. One thing that's worth noting is when one looks at this not on an undiscounted basis but a discounted basis, you again have a crossover between any of these regimes, whether it's Senate Bill 21, whether it's Bill 21 with the CS, or a number of other possible approaches. And the reason for that ultimately comes down to the question of capital credits, which is that when one looks on a time-discounted basis, capital credits actually count for quite a lot in ACEs. And if one evaluates government take, not treating all time periods as identical, but treating cash flows, positive or negative, in the near term as more valuable than cash flows in the future. What one actually sees is, for a new development like this, an overall very high level of government take under ACE is about 80%. But one where any of these options looks substantially better than ACE's from $90 a barrel onwards, but below that can still potentially, if one looks on a discounted rather than an undiscounted basis, be higher than level of government take under ACE's is. That again is because while there is a credit in here, it's a credit that's not tied to spending, and so if one thinks about the cash flows of developing a project, one first of all has negative cash flow early on as one incurs development expenses and then positive cash flow later on. What the credit helps with is those early negative cash flows, which it reduces and improves the project economics. So when one looks at government take on that discounted basis, when one doesn't have the benefit of that up front, that's why there comes a price level at which, if one's looking at a discounted rather than an undiscounted basis, it's an increase in government take, but a decrease at all the prices above. If we raise that, the cost of that new development from $16 a barrel to $25 a barrel, looking first of all at the undiscounted government take, again, because of the gross revenue exclusion, lower than ACEs, but once more there's a crossover point, and that crossover point moves up a bit to about $75 a barrel. But overall, it's relatively speaking, a higher level of government take than one sees, for instance, under Senate Bill 21, because, of course, of the higher base rate compensated, at least in part, by the production credit. Slide on the right, one needs to understand that with any high-cost development, there comes a point at which government take no longer becomes a meaningful metric because at a certain price level, there is no divisible income to go around. That's what's happening here at sort of a little under the $100 a barrel mark. But again, really all this is showing is, particularly if what one is comparing is ACEs versus the purple line, which is SB21 with the 35% base and the $5 a barrel production credit, that again, there's a crossover there, and that crossover is relatively higher than it was, for instance, under Senate Bill 21, when one is looking at a high-cost new development. Finally, to look at what this looks like for looking at incremental analysis for an incumbent producer. So not looking at the project on a standalone basis, but rather what it looks like when one first of all looks at the overall economics of the base production, adds on to that the new development, and subtracts one from the other. What does that look like in terms of levels of government take? And for a $16 a barrel development, once again, at that lower cost level, the crossover is substantially lower, and you don't have the crossing of where the yellow line for Senate Bill 21 without the CS is a tax increase for a $16 a barrel a day new development at around the $75 mark when one does the analysis on an incremental basis. That's not the case, or at least it's not the case at these price levels for Senate Bill 21 with the CS, as in the 35% base and the $5 a barrel production credit. When one does it on a discounted basis, what one sees is that really it's only at very high levels, if what one is looking at is discounted government take, that you actually get levels of government take that are lower than they are under ACEs. And that is only exacerbated further by looking at a $25 a barrel field, where you'll notice that to focus solely on the undiscounted government take comparison, essentially a similar crossover to, in terms of price levels, about $85 a barrel for the $25 a barrel development on an incremental basis for the existing producer, but a relatively lesser tax increase below that point than was the case under the bill without before the CS. If we look, instead of looking at government take, actually to go back one second, once again to put this into perspective, thinking about, for instance, 60 to 65% government take as being back in that area of competitiveness as we saw on the first slide. If we look at instead at net present value at a 12% discount rate per barrel of reserves for a development, we see a significant improvement for the base production under either Senate Bill 21 with or without the CS, although again because overall the level of government take is more about the 65% mark than the 60% mark. It's a slight reduction compared to Senate Bill 21, and that's the case on both a discounted and an undiscounted basis. Again, if we look at a new development on a standalone basis, including the GRE, with all of these, there is a crossover point, even including the GRE, where at a low price level, economics look better under ACEs, but anything above that, they look substantially better under Senate Bill 21. However, that crossover point rises with the CS from $75 a barrel in this case to between $85 and $90 a barrel for the $16 a barrel new development. And if we move on to what this looks like at $25 a barrel, you'll notice that none of these things have positive net present value above about the $90 barrel mark, but that the crossover between ACEs versus Senate Bill 21 with the CS rises from being about that $90 barrel mark to being more like $100, $105 a barrel. That again is an impact of the higher base rate when one looks at this level being only partially compensated by the $5 per taxable barrel production credit. So you can see that there are, when we look at the overall level of the base production, 35% base with the $5 a barrel production credit looks really like the perfect Goldilocks regime. Very flat, very neutral, and right on where I think a lot of people are looking to go in terms of overall levels of government take. When you drill down into the details of new developments, for instance, it seems to me that there may be further sources of concern and things that one might want to look at further to see if one can improve the way that the overall picture works. Finally, the crossover point is highest on an incremental basis, and that in many ways is because of some of the things that have been discussed before in terms of the impact of buy-down to the extent that one thinks that incremental rather than standalone economics is the way to analyze these things, that helps ACEs up to a point particularly. But ultimately what one sees is a crossover where under Senate Bill 21, somewhere in the low hundreds, Senate Bill 21 without the CS crosses over and has higher net present value for a $16 barrel a day new development on an incremental basis, but that moves a little higher, only marginally, but a little higher under the CS. And in particular, both are substantially higher in terms of that crossover point when one looks at it for an expensive $25 a barrel new development. So again, some strong points in terms of overall level of government take, particularly when looking at the base portfolio, but more sources for concern in terms of looking at some of the other economic metrics and what they look like for a new development, both on a standalone basis, though that's assisted by the gross revenue exclusion for a completely new producing project, but particularly for when the gross revenue exclusion doesn't apply, that's where potentially we have some sources of concern. Similarly, when it comes to rates of return, The crossover between point of where does the rate of return under Senate Bill 21 versus under ACES become higher rather than lower compared to ACES. With the CS, that crossover point is relatively speaking higher, both for the $16 barrel development and for $25 barrel development, and that's going to be the case. All of them, of course, look worse on an incremental basis, but that once again sort of comes back to that fundamental question of incremental analysis and whether one believes that that's fundamentally the best way of looking at this. In particular, and I think Mr. Pulliam sort of has shown this before, he certainly illustrated this with some useful slides in the House an hour or two ago, the very high levels of IRR that you can get under ACES when one was looking at an incremental basis for a new producer are really a sort of quirk of progressivity, and one has the counterintuitive result that the higher progressivity is, the higher IRR you can get on an incremental basis for a project that really says nothing whatsoever about the quality of the project or the economic value it creates. It's simply a quirk of the phenomenon of buy-down. One of the best ways to think about, I think of thinking about this is thinking about imagining one had a 100% tax rate where you could receive nothing, but you could, with each dollar of spending, could buy down your rate. That first dollar of spending that brought you down from 100 to 99% would have infinite rate of return. So it seems to me more than anything that question of high rates of return under ACES looking solely at incremental analysis is a phenomenon of the problems of incremental analysis, not a fundamental benefit of ACES as a regime.
Questions for Mr. Mayor? Senator Michiki, any comments? The goal had been to levelize the take a bit more.
Well, I'm happy to cover that. And what the goal was we heard complaints that the take was too high of a tax increase on the low end. We heard that people, including many senators, didn't like the slightly aggressive nature of the original SB 21. And we do have administration folks here that may, when we get to it, I'm not sure, it's up to you, but they can answer some of those questions. They were helpful in this process.
Well, Senator Michiki, perhaps it would be helpful to ask the administration. We had asked them if they also had a thought on this.
Okay, let me cover, cover what our goal was. And so we looked at that. We looked at smoothing out the curve. We looked at a couple of different ways to do that. There was a step suggestion, but it had its own difficulties. So remember that our concept was to create a slightly progressive system without using progressivity, but to preserve the simplicity of the governor's proposal. This CS achieves that by raising the base rate and then offsetting it with a per barrel credit. Since the tax rate was raised, we also had to fix with corresponding changes to the gross revenue exclusion, and that increased the GL rate to 30%. Here's where administration can help when you bring them up. And the loss carry forward was also increased to 35%. So we like the curve. We like the slightly progressive nature of it, and we like the fact that it's a smaller fiscal note while still putting us at that competitive level with other OECD producing areas where we wanted to be. And I think it's a good solution, and it'd be a good time to bring the administration up to chat.
We can ask the administration. They have a consultant also that has modeled this. You know, one of the things that we've really emphasized is we didn't want to create a runaway schedule of credits, mm-hmm. which would incentivize spending and not production. And so while you have suggested that we raise that base rate, we're also giving back $5 per barrel for produced oil. So Mr. Pulliam is here with Econ One, and I believe the Department of Revenue as well. If you have comment on this suggested change to Senate Bill 21. We would welcome your input.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Faircloth has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was reference to a fiscal note, and so I was pleased to receive the CS an hour ago. But I'm wondering if there is a fiscal note then in process, because Senator Michicki referred to the fiscal note, and what I can't tell right now is the overall effect of the different components that have been included. And so do we have indication from the department when we might see a fiscal note?
I'll ask the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Michael Pulowski. I'm the advisor for Petroleum Fiscal Systems to the Commissioner of Revenue. The fiscal impact of the proposed committee substitute is being evaluated, as we saw it, I think, relatively as soon as you did. The comment about the fiscal impact of the bill rather than the fiscal note, I think, is readily apparent in the government take numbers themselves, that there's an inferral that can be taken from that, that at the current range of prices, the government take under the proposed committee substitute to Senate Bill 21 is higher than the proposal that the governor introduced. So in that there's a higher government take, there should be more revenue coming to the state. So I think it's an inferral more than it is a specific number at this point. We are working on that analysis to give to the committee as we review the committee substitute as well.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Pulowski. Do you have comment on this portion of the CS? You have Mr. Pulliam here from Econ 1? If you would like to,
Madam Chair, if I could, we had received the information and asked Mr. Pulliam to run it through his models. We've been kind of scrambling through the day to get that together for you. So, I think I'd just make the comment with Mr. Pulliam as well that this information is relatively preliminary, and he can speak to some of the slides that you just saw from PFC. But as we understood the proposal, it was a 35% base rate with a $5 per barrel production credit. And in combination with that was the 30% gross revenue exclusion, and as well the increase of the loss carry forward to 35%. But those were the knobs that the committee was moving to try and preserve the new entrance economics. And that's what we asked Mr. Pulliam to model for the committee. So if I can, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Pulliam.
That'd be great. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, Barry Pulliam with Econ One. Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for allowing me to speak to the CS here. This slide that you have in front of you shows a revision to a slide that I had presented last week when I was here. And I've added into this the government take line for the proposal that you are considering. The 35% flat rate with the $5 barrel, you've called it a credit. I refer to it here as a production allowance. So the base rate is raised to $35, but you get a $5 allowance or credit for every barrel that's produced. You can see the effect on government take, and here I'm showing you the government take over the period of what would be a fiscal note, essentially fiscal year 2015 through 19. This is a conglomeration of all existing producers on the North Slope. The effect of this change is to increase government take somewhat from the low 60% range to a range that approaches 65% at prices above $80, $90 a barrel, and to reduce government take at prices below $80 a barrel. Down closer to where it was under ACES. And the way that it accomplishes this, essentially, is you can think about it as a modification of the GRE. The GRE gives an allowance that is a percentage of the production value. In SB 21, it was 20%. And that allowance in terms of a dollar per barrel amount would rise with higher prices and fall with lower prices. By allowing a per barrel allowance, you're essentially putting in a GRE that as a percentage increases with lower prices, and so it helps out more so than just a standard percentage-based GRE, and declines with higher prices. So it bends that curve just a little bit and accomplishes at least what we've heard are the goals of providing some lower taxes at lower levels, getting closer to what ACE has had, and a little bit higher take at higher levels, closer to what you see on average throughout the world. And let me just take you, if I can, through a little example of how it works.
If I may, Madam Chair, I believe we tried to have copies of these available right as the committee was starting for members, and I just want to make sure you got them or didn't.
We don't have them, no. Would you please distribute them? Thank you. While we're waiting, Senator Fairclough had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, it was a point that I had sent a note to my staff to make sure that we were pulling up so the general public had an opportunity to see the same document. So we were trying to get access to your document so that we could post it online for people that are trying to follow us. So that was it. And the second question or statement was, I hope that the fiscal note will be able to reflect specifically what the $5 means in the term of total dollars when the fiscal note comes forward. I just want to know what that particular knob is doing inside the modeling.
Senator Fairclough, through the chair, appreciate that direction. We'll put it into the same table format as was used in the bill that the governor introduced.
Thank you.
Great. Proceed, please, Mr. Pulliam.
This slide is a revision of an earlier slide that I'd shown you last week, but it shows how the system would work with this allowance at different prices. So I've modeled here prices from $60 to $160 a barrel with total lease expenditures of $30 a barrel. And you can see as you come down, I'll just focus on the first column here, which is the $60, a very low price. Under that scenario, you'd have a total production tax value. You'd have taxable barrel value of $20, so $60 West Coast, $20 a barrel taxable, a production tax value of $1 million. If you applied a 35% tax rate, that would be a tax obligation of $350 million. Then you would take your per barrel allowance of $5 against that. In this case, we're assuming a producer of 50 million barrels. So that allowance, 50 million times 5, is $250 million, reduces the tax after the allowance to $100 million. The effect of that here is you start with what is a nominal rate of 35%, and after the allowance, you reduce the effective rate to 10%. And you can see as you go across there, you see and highlighted in the yellow in the bottom, the value of that allowance, while it stays at $5 a barrel, as you go up in price, on a percentage basis, the value of the allowance declines. And so the effective tax rate rises from 10, and if you go all the way to $160 a barrel, you could be at a 30% tax rate. And that's about where it would cap out under this proposal. And you can see also I've tried to show, illustrate this, the value that this provides by giving it as a per barrel number. In that bottom line, you can see that as a percentage of the gross value at $60 a barrel, that $5 is that's 5% of the wellhead value. And that's where, you know, that the projects become challenged. So that bigger percentage at the lower price is helpful for your project economics.
Yes, Senator Machicki.
Mr. Pulliam, as we've heard through this, through the testimony, this helps in analyzing projects in the price range where companies evaluate projects. That was another goal of this change. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. It provides additional support at the lower price range, and it does so without getting into the messiness of a progressive net tax, which I think is important, and it'll one of the things I like about it is it's the allowance or the credit is tied to barrels, it's tied to production, and the value of it increases at lower prices and fades away at higher prices where you don't really need it. So it's a nice way of providing, I think, a credit tied to production and achieving a flat to slightly progressive. Well, it's really over most of the price range. It's a flat take. Where it gets progressive is at the lower price ranges. You drop your take. And like Mr. Mayor, I've also looked at the impact on new projects from this at both a $16 and a $25 level for costs, and incorporated, you see column 4 is the 35.5 with a 30% GRE, and we compare that with, say, column 2, which would be SB 21 with the GRE, and you can see that the net present value at all price levels is enhanced under this proposal, as are all of the other investment metrics. If you go down to the bottom, you'll see that for this new production, you'd actually have a government take that would be right at about 60% for a new investment, a very competitive take. And it's the same thing. While the present value of the project isn't as attractive at that $25 level, it's more attractive under this proposal than it is under SB 21. So I think it accomplishes a lot of what you're looking to do, and supports the producer's economics in an important and meaningful way.
Questions, committee members? Follow-up comments, Senator Michiki. This was a concept that you put forth. Any additional comments?
We'll be looking forward to hearing from other stakeholders and the public on it. It accomplishes what I hope to accomplish, and that was improving the economics on the low end and the price where we hear companies evaluate projects. And I like the fact that it's slightly progressive without using progressivity, and a little bit more take for Alaskans, but not in a way that puts us out of the ballpark on being competitive. So I'm grateful for the work of the administration, Mr. Pawlowski and Balash, as well as Mr. Pulliam. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator McGuire.
I know that Senator Bishop worked really hard on this as well, and had expressed some concerns about the progressive nature of Senate Bill 21. So I wondered if he wanted to make some comments as well.
Senator Bishop?
Looking at your modeling, I think it's as close to hitting a sweet spot as you can get for now, and as I have time to really look over these slides over the weekend, I'll reserve further comment until next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. I want to just let the public know that the committee substitute is on basis, as well as Mr. Pulliam's slides. We're working to get Mr. Mayor's slides up also, so the public has full access to all of this discussion and the data that we're looking at. Any further questions on this piece? Okay, so this is the 35.5 provision in our committee substitute. Great, thank you, gentlemen. I will have Ms. Long return to the table, and we'll continue progressing through some of the other changes that were proposed and included in this committee substitute. The next change has already been alluded to, and that is the expansion of the gross revenue exclusion. Well, actually, pardon me, it hasn't been alluded to. It is an expansion of the gross revenue exclusion to include legacy fields. And enlarging participating areas. Ms. Long?
Yes, Madam Chair. If the committee members would turn to page 26. Starts on page 26, line 26. It's section 28 of the bill. And if you'll turn over, then it continues on to page 27. And starting on line 3, that little number 3 right at the end of that line is where the addition, the change from the CS occurs. And this is the language down through line 11, which allows expanded PAs and existing units. These are the legacy fields that we heard so much about in testimony. There is another little change on line 3. They want to change December 31st. They changed January 1st to December 31st, 2011, small change. And then also our own legal department, Mr. Bullock, suggested that we have a definition of participating area, and you'll see that on line 10 where it describes a participating area, and that may need some further discussion. And we have the folks whose jurisdiction it is to administer these things are here if you care to have them expand on it. Mr. Joe Balash with the Department of Natural Resources.
That would be great. I also want to highlight that on page 26, the GRE is financially yes. altered in that it is a reduction of 30%. That had been a 20% reduction. It is now a 30% in this CS, and that's on page 26, line 29.
Yes, and that was triggered by the 35.5 amendment. And there's also another small adjustment there on line 30. We changed the word land to lease. It was a request we heard in testimony, and Mr. Balish can speak to how that facilitates the industry.
Thank you. Mr. Balish, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Natural Resources. The language referenced by Ms. Long on page 27, at the end of line 3, continuing on down to line 8, makes an addition to the two ways in which you could qualify for the GRE relative to the governor's original bill. This addition would be to include expansions of a participating area. I think the committee has heard in testimony from various operators how new technology is allowing them to reach certain parts of the reservoir that previously were not available. So as that kind of work unfolds, it seems to us that expansions of those original PAs will be needed in the future as we go forward, and those expansions, as long as we're able to track and count the barrels, it seems reasonable to us to apply the same logic and policy to those expansions as we would apply to new participating areas. So it fits consistent with the original concept and in terms of capturing what is new oil.
Very good. Just to remind committee members, Mr. Bill Barron from the Division of Oil and Gas was here, presented an explanation to us about the participating areas. We have heard from companies, and Senator McGuire actually has expressed significant concern that with the increase in technology, companies are able to reach yet further out and access new areas and actually broaden the participating area. So that was what this change was intended to capture. We heard from ConocoPhillips that the GRE was not broad enough. I actually have notes here on their slide that the legacy fields need to be part of the GRE. And so that's what we were attempting to capture with this change in Senate Bill 21. Any comments from committee members or questions for Mr. Balash about this element, this idea?
I just have a brief comment.
Senator Ritchie.
I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, for
been very satisfied with the process. We put a lot of work into the TAPS committee, and you embrace those concepts, and you've carried them through, and I certainly hope all of our work is certainly evaluated as fairly as it moves forward. But the GRE expansion is favorable and something we captured in TAPS as well. So just thank you for the way you've handled this process.
Well, thank you, Senator Machiki. We actually have several other elements that the TAPS Throughput Committee put forward that we've worked on. Any additional comments, Mr. Bailash?
Madam Chair, yes. If members would return to page 26, line 30, the language for the first test for qualifying for the GRE, the oil or gas is produced from a lease or property that does not contain a lease that was within a unit on January 1, 2003. The original language had read that it does not contain land that was within a unit. And I think as Brooks Range testified on Monday of this week, some of the leases they hold today that are part of the Mustang unit on that date were actually part of one of the legacy units. So we had to be specific as to the lease, not the land, because in the intervening time, the land was contracted out of the Kaparik River unit and released. Brooks Range picked it up. And so with this fix, that should correct that particular problem.
Excellent. Questions, committee members? Comment. Yes, Senator Bishop.
Comment. Joe, I'd just like to, maybe a follow-up later. You had made a comment about counting and tracking barrels. And if you want to get back with me later on that, I'd appreciate it.
I would appreciate, Madam Chair, an opportunity to speak that here on the record.
I would like you to do that on the record as much as possible.
Yes, thank you. So on page 27, again, referring to the expanded PA's language, if you look at line 6, about halfway through, and the producer demonstrates to the department that the volume of oil and gas produced is from an area added to an existing participating area. That is where the taxpayer has the burden to demonstrate to the department. In this case, it's a small d, and in this section of statute, that refers to the Department of Revenue. And in that fashion, the burden is on the company to prove that those barrels are being counted.
Thank you.
Very good. Other questions? In this section, Senator Fairclough.
Sorry, I'm trying to capture what was just said, that that's the Department
Absolutely.
Of Revenue?
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could you explain to Alaskans how you might quantify new production in this instance so that we might understand better how the department would analyze what new production would be?
Sure, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the way we manage our oil and gas leases is through leases, units, and then participating areas. Leases and units are measured in two dimensions. A unit is a way of managing multiple leases that contain an oil or gas reservoir. That reservoir rests in a third dimension. The leases and units are in two dimensions. And as those deposits are shaped across the different leases within that unit, certain parts of that reservoir, when penetrated with a well, actually contribute to the production in that well. And they use reservoir engineering and analytics to determine which parts of the reservoir are actually contributing to that production in the wellbore. It is through that analysis that the participating areas are then defined in the unit. And so by identifying specifically new participating areas, we're talking about parts of the unit that are not today contributing to production, and so by definition would be new production, new oil being produced on behalf of Alaskans. Where we're getting into this new facet, the expansion of an existing PA, again, we're talking about land that previously was not determined to have been contributing to production. So we're talking about new parts of the reservoir that will now in the future be contributing new barrels to help sustain TAPS.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know that you went into that before, and I greatly appreciated that conversation, but I wanted to follow it up here today so that those that might be listening for the first time would understand that we're looking at reservoirs a bit differently now. That said, my only other comment is, are there other jurisdictions that actually sell royalties based on that third dimension?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, we have at times talked about segregating our leases vertically, and we've not done that with any of our existing leases, but even in Alaska, we will sell the oil and gas rights in the subsurface, but not necessarily the coal rights or the gold rights, and so to a degree, there is a distinction, but this participating area concept is, my understanding is common to the industry.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Balash. The next element that's been suggested by committee members to include in this bill is something called a competitiveness review board. Ms. Long, would you take us to the section of the bill which contains this, and then I'm going to have Senator McGuire, who has put this idea forth, have her speak to it.
And Madam Chair, there was one other comment that that you had requested back on the GRE, that there'd been a lot of discussion over during this legislature and in previous legislatures about not incentivizing or not rewarding the industry for that which they were going to produce anyway, and you had requested in the drafting of this that we try to get at that new oil, and this amendment puts the burden on the industry to have to prove that it's new oil, and they count those barrels and differentiate them from that which would otherwise not have been produced. But the burden is not on our department, it's on the industry. So
excuse me, Ms. Long, so you're referring to page 27 of the bill and lines, yes. I'm looking at 6 through 8.
Which Mr. Balash just referred, but I thought I'd emphasize where the burden of making that differentiation lies, we believe, with this language. So on to competitiveness review board, which is something else that's been talked about over a couple of legislatures. And go to page 27. And that would start on line 12. It goes over to page 29. And all the way down that page, it sets out the membership of the board and how they're appointed, the information that will be provided by the board. Down at the bottom of the page, there's a sunset for the Competitiveness Review Board, which we're all familiar with sunsets and how they work. And the most familiar person in the room with this concept is sitting with you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator McGuire, would you like to speak to this?
You bet. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank you again. Senator Machicki thanked you, and others have thanked you. But you, first of all, I mean, it's a tough process to go through with an omnibus bill like this, working with the administration. And obviously, we've thanked Mr. Balash and Mr. Pulaski for their work, but thank you to them as well and the respect that they've had for the legislature, working with all of us and our various fits of pique as well. But to try and drive a bill like this through with a time schedule and knowing that it is the priority for the Senate majority, respecting the public the way that you have, knowing that they would like to have each of them, I'm sure, at least 30 minutes or more to speak, and many of them have the kind of wisdom and experience that would warrant at least 30. But knowing that our time just doesn't allow for that, thank you for that. And then to get all of our ideas incorporated into this document, thank you so much for the respect that you've had for the process. There has not been a better first-time chair to this committee that I'm aware of at all in my 13 years. So I thank you for that. This has been a concept that I have proposed now for a couple of years, and this is the time is ripe. And I look forward to it because it hasn't been ripe yet because it has been without the proper rollback of ACEs. and that's what was missing in the past. We did come up with a rollback for new fields, but we didn't get the legacy fields into it, and so it wasn't ready. Energy prices are volatile. We know that. There's increasing competition for global capital all across, and now including in the lower 48. It used to just be globally, but it's actually in the lower 48 now. Continued production of Alaska oil and gas is dependent on capital investment. Other jurisdictions have stepped up to attract that capital, and now we know that our budget is completely dependent, 90%, on this particular revenue. And if we don't get our act together quickly, we're in a whole heap of trouble. It strikes me in my 13 years that our discussions have been so politicized when it comes to the effort of oil and gas taxes. And so I have thought over the years that putting together a board, in this case it would be 9 members, the commissioners of the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Revenue, the Commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Chairperson of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and then 5 members of the public, which would be selected by the governor. They would include a petroleum engineer, a geologist, an economist. All of them would have at least 3 years of experience in the field. A person from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and the Support Industry Alliance, picked by the governor. They would serve on this particular board without compensation, so it would be truly public service, but they would be eligible for per diem and travel expenses. This particular board would come together, and they would meet at least 4 times a year, and they would make recommendations to the legislature about how to keep Alaska competitive. Throughout the year, they would meet without a political agenda, and that's what I think we need. This is our mainstay. It is 90% of our economy. They would be looking around the globe. They'd be looking at the lower 48 to see what are the emerging trends, how are other places staying competitive, what are the kinds of things that Alaska could do in our fiscal regime, what are the kinds of things that we can do in our regulatory process. They'd review historical, current, and potential levels of investment, rig counts, identify factors that affect investment in oil and gas across the world, make recommendations to the legislature to increase Alaska's competitiveness, and make those reports to us. Again, it's the legislature that gets to make the decisions about how we change our fiscal system. So we're not delegating anything about that ultimate control of the purse strings that we're vested with in the Constitution. But we get that report, and it's an opportunity for us to review what they've said in this independent, apolitical process, and then strike up that conversation. In the past, it's been sad to see that often it will be a politically charged conversation that will lead us into the dialogue, and then it's partisan in nature, and then can be highly charged when we do it. So it's my hope that it will be these professionals, it will be the industry leaders. I see members from the Alliance here in the audience. I know there are probably folks from AOGA, I see folks from DNR, DOR, and DEC here as well. But those folks that really deal with the industry day in and day out, that know what's happening, they're watching Alberta, they're watching Venezuela, they're watching North Dakota, and they know what it would take to keep Alaska competitive, that can make these recommendations. And I'll wrap up by saying, Madam Chair, that it's a personal story that brought me to this. When I was president of the Pacific Northwest Economic Region, my friend who was here a couple of weeks ago, Mel Knight, who is the Minister of Energy, for the province of Alberta, they went through a very similar situation that we did. They had high side oil like we did. It was a global high side oil. And the public asked for a similar thing. They said, let's take advantage of this opportunity and capture more of it. They went into a session and adopted a windfall profits tax, much like ACEs. And the backlash was immediate on the part of the oil companies, and they voted with their feet. They moved their rigs, their operations to Saskatchewan and to the province of British Columbia, and actually globally to other parts of the world. And they suffered immensely because, much like Alaska, that is their mainstay, their bread and butter. And it's a parliamentary system there, and so many of them were voted out of office. And so they put together a very similar thing, a competitiveness review panel, and it was very successful. And that's what I want to point out, is that this competitiveness review board and the process that they went through was extremely effective, came back with a recommendation, a series of recommendations, which the parliament put into place, and now they're back on their feet. They've put those recommendations into effect, and Alberta is back on track and extremely competitive. So it's my hope that this will be a part of Alaska's governance for the future, much like we have a permanent fund board that sits in perpetuity and sits outside of the legislative structure and, again, is apolitical. So I offer this as a part of this package that goes forward.
Thank you very much, Senator McGuire. Comments from other committee members? Very good. The next element that we've included in this bill actually are some cleanups, which are sometimes seem trite, but they're actually rather important. Ms. Long, do you want to address some cleanups?
Our cleanups start on page 10, and the first thing this does is it combines Section 7 and 8 from the previous bill, and that was suggested to us by legislative legal, and Mr. Bullock, I believe, is aware, and he can speak to the utility of combining those two. And the other one, cleanup B, is on page 15. And again, our legislative legal people suggested on lines 9 and 10 and on lines 17 and 18 just a better usage and phraseology. And so they just moved part of a phrase from the end of a sentence up into the middle of a sentence. And again, legal's here to speak to the utility of that. The other cleanup was our legal folks thought it was important to have the definition of participating area to be included with in the GRE amendment, and we already spoke to that. So I don't know if you want them to speak further to those items or.
Committee members, any question? You know, cleanup things are typically sentence structure, punctuation kinds of things that the lawyers in legislative legal find. Any questions about those cleanups? All right. We'll go on then to another element that's been advocated, and actually this element was brought forward by AOGA, Alaska Oil and Gas Association, as well as Brooks Range as they spoke to us, and this is the Exploration Incentive Credit. Ms. Long, would you like to?
Margaret's going to speak to that.
I will let.
Madam Chair, Margaret Dowling, staff to Senator Giesel, and good afternoon. The Exploration Incentive Credit, as you said, was something that was brought to the attention of the committee and discussed at length during their presentations. And so in response to that, we did make a change, which you can find on page 18. And what we did was we took the current law, which allows an exploration incentive credit, and it is set in current law to expire in 2016. We extended that time to 2022. In addition, you'll find on page 20, line 18, we heard from Brooks Range that the distance around a well within which they could not qualify for an additional credit was too tight, and so what we did was we basically eliminated that 3-mile restriction, and that's found on page 20, line 18 through line 20. That language has been removed from the statute, and DNR is here and they can talk about that in more detail.
That would be great. I think it would be important to kind of flesh that out a bit. I do have, in fact, IOGA's recommendation here for the for the exploration incentive credit, extending that. And I will remind committee members that when Brooks Range spoke to us, they showed us a map similar to this about the very tight 3-mile boundary around a well. So if DNR would be available to speak to this portion. Again, our goal as we took public testimony was to hear from producers, citizens, as well as our own thoughts on issues. So that's what's been incorporated here. Welcome, Mr. Balash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Joe Balash, Department of Natural Resources. I would refer members to page 20, line 8, where this is speaking to the requirements and qualifications in order to be able to get this 025 exploration credit, and requires that the Commissioner of Natural Resources must make an affirmative determination as to the geological objective of the well. So basically what we have in this particular credit mechanism is a gate. You have to come in and demonstrate to DNR, and it's not really Dan Sullivan, it's actually the technical guys in DOG that do this review, to make sure that in fact something new is being looked at or looked for. In order to qualify as an exploration credit. Assuming that threshold is met, that's sort of a front-end gate. Then the well is drilled, the costs are accounted for, and the information from that well then needs to be shared with DNR again in order to qualify for the credit and receive it. So there's a check on the front end and a check on the back end, making sure that we as a state get something for what is, I think you would hear from Mr. Mayor, that this is a generous credit. It is a certain amount of risk that the state is taking along with the company on what is the riskiest part of oil and gas development. It's that exploration side.
Questions for Mr. Balash from committee members? All right, great, thank you. Any further to add?
Just, I think, just so that everybody does understand what is being done here by eliminating the 3-mile limit, this, in years past, there have been limits tied to unit boundaries and distance from other wells. This eliminates all of those limitations. So even if we're talking about an exploration well within a unit, if as long as it is targeting something new, then you've got the potential to qualify, and really that should help in taking on some of the opportunities that are close to and nearer to the existing producing units that we believe are out there and quite prevalent.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you explain to us what the liability or potential liability on the exploration credit is, first in the from a percentage basis and then into a dollar amount for the people of Alaska?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the credit in this particular case is set at 40%, and typically a well, a winter exploration well drilled on the North Slope costs around $15 million. Now, that cost goes up depending on how far away it is. You've got to build ice roads and maybe even set up a temporary man camp. So sort of the cheapest exploration well is going to run about $15 million. 40% of that is going to run somewhere in the $8 million range. No, $6 million range.
Follow-up, Senator Fairclough? Okay, thank you for that explanation. Yes, Senator Michiki.
However, it could no longer, it has to be taken against production. So we're not exposed on the...
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I believe that these particular credits fall in the category of those which are available for either transfer or refunding on that front end.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chairman. Yes, Senator Fairclough.
As we continue to explore options like this, one of the questions that had been raised in the TAPS throughput committee was the qualification of the explorers on the North Slope. And do Alaskans really want to participate with all comers? And I'm wondering then if we have any gate or potential criteria that we're using as we become partners at a 40% level with those that are that we hope to be part of our renaissance.
Madam Chair, or through the Chair, Senator Fairclough, my quick read of the statute as it's shown here, I'd have to take a look at some of the additional provisions, but if that were a particular type of qualification that the legislature were interested in having, I think that's something that would need to be spelled out somewhere.
Madam Chairman, I won't hold up here. I'll work offline to see if there's an amendment that we might draft. I certainly don't want to discourage exploration, but one of the things that was brought to our attention, specifically by Senator Michiki, was what are we doing to make sure that people coming potentially from other countries that may not understand Alaska's weather conditions and the challenges that they face here. If I think we called it Fairclough and Company, if I decided to go up and drill, which I have no intent in doing, and I believe I do not own any exploration, anything, anywhere, but using that as an example, I'm not qualified as a myself, or I don't think I'm qualified. So we've said I could, Fairclough and Company could, under my example, qualify for the exploration credit if someone was foolish enough to capitalize me for this venture. So I'm just interested in if there are some threshold criteria, whether it's in capitalization or something else that we might use as a bar to jump over so that we have people with prospects that actually can follow through on production, that I would be interested in including those in the bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Excellent suggestion, Senator Fairclough. Senator Michiki.
And I know we'll have a letter of intent, so if we, if you don't feel like you have the time to nail all of that down, we can certainly pass that on to the next. But just if I can make another comment,
yes,
I think this, was a question that Senator Bishop had as well. This definitely helps some of the smaller companies for initial exploration, and the elimination of the 3-mile limit helps them even more. And if I'm correct, with all of our testimony we've had from the folks that know best, the most likely new oil that will at least arrest the decline is likely to come from infield and could be in areas that this makes accessible to not only some of the newer companies but legacy companies as well.
Through the Chair, Senator Michiki, that's correct. And just as a point of emphasis, really, the role that credits can play and the role we're trying to keep them to is to incentivize those activities to go find the oil and then allow the value of the oil itself to drive the economic decision-makings and financing and ultimately the development, as opposed to the credit cycle.
Yes, absolutely. Further questions for Mr. Balash on this issue? All right, thank you, Mr. Balash. Mr. Mayor, would you like to comment? Mr. Balash referred to you being knowledgeable about the generosity of this credit. Would you like to add comment to that?
Madam Chair, very briefly. I'll say, first of all, that in general, exploration risk is, in particular, the part of it's both by far the largest risk in upstream oil and gas and the part that governments around the world usually seek desperately to avoid. Alaska is unusual in the degree to which it happily takes on exploration risk. That is particularly the case at the moment where under the Act as it stands, one has 40% exploration credit. If one is not a current producer, then also on top of that, the 25% net operating loss credit, both claimable straight from the Treasury. So if Fairclough and Company decides to drill up some random moose pasture, they're drilling with 65 cents government, 45 cent dollars with 65 cents on the dollar paid for by the state of Alaska. If Fairclough and Company is an existing producer, potentially through the buy down, they actually are drilling with even greater government effective support than that. So it's quite unusual to have that high a degree of support of support for exploration risk, particularly when, as I say, it's a very risky business. It's one in which you put millions of dollars on the line, and as commonly as not, drill a dry hole and get no benefit from it. And for that reason alone, is an area that many governments around the world seek to divest risk and put it onto the private sector. On the one hand, clearly exploration is a valuable activity, and the state is right to seek to promote it. On the other hand, in terms of over the coming 5 to 10 years, the things that are going to push volumes in the TAPS pipeline have much more to do with the development of known resources than exploration.
Thank you. Questions? Did you want to follow up, Senator Fairclough?
I would just say that for those in the media or those watching, a disclaimer that I do not own an oil company. I'm using it as an example. And I do mean, yes, please, Fairclough & Company is not going into business. I have a business license, but it was better to put it on me to try to make the example, because I really appreciate all the explorers that are coming to Alaska. I just raise the issue in a very serious manner, that we want to make sure that we're partnering with companies that can be successful at delivering what Alaskans want, and that is more responsibly developed oil. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Senator Bishop had a question.
Mr. Jennings? I love economics. I think it's an art form. You're a little bit cautious and think we might be just a skosh generous, but we've heard for the last, 3 weeks, how much it costs to do business in Alaska.
Yeah.
And we're like no other province on the planet from an oil patch perspective. And I feel confident as an Alaskan taking a little risk to get this new production going in the pipe just because of what we've heard for the last 3 weeks. So it's debatable. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Further questions for Mr. Janik, or excuse me, Mr. Mayor. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mayor, I just wanted to thank you publicly for commuting back and forth from D.C. Being on a plane can be taxing. You've stood up to that test, and I really appreciate what you're contributing to the conversation. I know that as we move forward, that you'll be here on a more frequent basis and maybe have less frequent flyer miles. Just appreciate all that you've provided for us. And Madam Chair, everyone, or most everyone's taken the opportunity, but truly we have something on the table that Alaskans can chew on for a couple days. We can let the dust settle so that we understand how all the knobs are moving. I look forward to a fiscal note so that we can see if it's penciling, how you are moving this bill forward. But thank you so much for your leadership. I appreciate you being on time. I appreciate all of our folks that have come to testify, and I appreciate your allowance for the public hearing, as has been stated before, that all Alaskans are welcome at the table to have a conversation and be part of Alaska's future. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. The last element that we've included in this bill is quite an innovative one. And again, it comes from the TAPS Throughput Committee's letter of intent. They talked in that letter of intent about Alaska Hire and Alaska Purchase. Now, we know that Alaska Hire, as we think of it, is unconstitutional. We are Americans. We can move wherever we wish. We can work at whatever jobs we wish. However, a rather innovative idea has arisen from the committee. I will ask Ms. Long to share that and identify it in the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, would you and the committee please turn to page 2, line 10. And this is something that we're calling the corporate income tax break for Alaska manufacturing. And a primary concern in the legislature and all over the state is to have jobs for Alaskans and to encourage manufacturing here. And Department of Law and the courts seem to not agree with a lot of ideas that come up. And so we've come up with this one. We think it passes muster. Just an overview, it's a corporate income tax break for oil and gas sector goods made or modified in the state. It is transferable. It's a $10 million per year cap. If you don't have a $10 million tax liability in one given year, then you can carry that over for up to 7 years. And we spoke to the Department of Revenue about this and asked both Mr. Tangeman and Mr. Pulaski to be here to speak to how this would work.
Very good. Mr. Tangeman, would you come forward and help flesh out this provision? It's on page 2. It's section 2, and it actually goes, I think, all the way to page 3. Section 2 continues all the way to page 3.
Line 24.
Line 24. Yes, so it is a couple pages there. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Deputy Commissioner for Department of Revenue. Sharon did a very good job of explaining the what the intent of this language is. I would add that it's for expenditures directly attributable to in-state manufacture or in-state modification of tangible personal property used in exploration, development, and production of oil and gas. So it's a, again, like the other changes to the credits, it's a very targeted tax credit, specifically at the manufacturer and building of items that are related to the oil and gas industry. And they must be done in state.
So let's kind of flesh this out a bit. So Faircloth and Company is a manufacturing company. And perhaps they're located in Fairbanks and they produce something for the North Slope. How would this play out for that company?
Madam Chair, the expenditures attributable to an oil and gas depreciable item that the company would make would be allowed a 10% tax credit against the expenditures that go into that item. So the fact that it's being manufactured or modified in Fairbanks would allow for the 10% credit.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I suspect that that 10% credit would then allow that company to bid on the product or services at a lower rate than a competitor who it might also be bidding on it from somewhere else.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that's the intent, absolutely.
So let's expand this a bit. What if it's a company that's actually based, oh, I don't know, let's say in North Dakota, and they are producing a tangible item that's being used on the North Slope? Would they get this credit?
Madam Chair, no, they wouldn't. They would need to be have a corporate income tax or be a entity within the state of Alaska. So that they would not qualify if it's being produced outside.
So if they built a manufacturing facility next to Faircloth and Company in Fairbanks and actually had on the ground in Alaska producing that product in Alaska, would they then qualify?
Madam Chair, yes, they would. And I'd also like to point out it would go the opposite way. A company in Alaska that's manufacturing or producing something that sells outside of the state would also qualify for that. So as long as they're building it within the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Faircloth.
Madam Chairman, tongue-in-cheek, Faircloth and Company operates in East Anchorage and Eagle River.
Very good.
Bishop and Company. I
appreciate that clarification. So this this piece is actually aimed at incentivizing or helping our companies that are here on the ground in Alaska, employing Alaskans, and really helps bolster diversification of our economy, building products here on the ground. Any other comments from committee members on this one? Yes, Senator Faircloth.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Tangeman, can you talk to us about how this will affect Alaska's bottom line? The intent is hiring. Will this would be a stackable credit on other benefits that someone might receive? Can Can you talk about the play inside of the revenue component? I'm thinking about how a company might not have that liability, but those credits are carried forward. So they could accumulate up to $70 million, $60 million for the credits, and those would enter a market at a discounted rate, possibly, for a larger company that's paying taxes, because I was told they were transferable, and I've only briefly read. So can you talk about some of that play and how we might model that effect, receiving a benefit absolutely for Alaskans and Alaska Hire, and that may be worth the investment, but just talk a little bit more about how that might play.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, the intent is to, you're correct, if they don't have a tax liability or their liability is less than the credit they would receive, it is a transferable credit. But that should also go into the economics of the pricing involved in the manufacturing of whatever they're producing in state. So that should help, the tax credit should help with the cost of that. And then when they're dealing with the buyers, that can be taken into account in the economics of that also. So it is a 10% tax credit. There is a $10 million cap. Hopefully this will spur more investment, more production of items in the state. That again, this comes off of the, it's attached to the corporate income tax. So as things are built in the state, corporate income tax liabilities for companies go up, and hopefully it will be a spur it that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ponder on the issue. I just need to think about it. I know that we've had a discussion about Alaska's tax credit liabilities, and mm-hmm. that in other places around the building we're looking at corporate income tax, and I just want to see how that relates out. And then Senator Dyson's question actually made me think about the bill that I'm carrying on small procurement and realigning Alaska bidder preferences, and wondering exactly how much could be stacked and what that will look like to Alaska's revenue stream. But I'll think about that more. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Like everybody probably playing catch-up here and trying to figure this out, I was startled when you said that an Alaskan company could get this credit for products that went outside.
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, it's for the sale of a product to an outside. What I was really referring to is an Alaskan company building or manufacturing something in Alaska, selling to an oil field in North Dakota.
That's what I meant. Yeah, that startled me a little bit.
Hopefully in a good way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, we want jobs, but why pick out this particular industry to subsidize their manufacturing as opposed to the fishing boat manufacturer or whatever else? I was very comfortable with it doing for Alaskan outfit for the oil and gas industry, but once you get, then it was a new thought to me, and I am not yet convinced, but I've just looked at it a little bit. But because I thought this, and you might have some title problems here, because this whole thing has to do with oil and gas in our state. And all of a sudden you've slipped in a section here talks about subsidizing an industry selling products outside that has nothing to do with our oil and gas. But for what it's worth.
Senator Faircloth.
Madam Chair, the tax credits have to stay within Alaska and be used on Alaska base, so our tax credits wouldn't go anywhere else, as a simple clarification. But there is still some dynamics at play in incentivizing an industry. What I was thinking about, if I might, is the fabrication of pipe. If we wanted a natural gas pipeline and we were bringing in flat steel, because that at one time was a conversation about getting a gas line in Alaska manufacturing here, so we take that pipe and then we start rounding it here, and so in that instance, since company would qualify for up to $10 million a year. And again, for me, where in the revenue process do we are we bottlenecking the cash flow that we're trying to make sure that we've safeguarded in other sections of the bill. And I just need to think about it. I think that it's an interesting concept, and it certainly would incentivize manufacturing in the state of Alaska. I'm not sure what the transportation costs will look like, but manufacturing.
Mr. Pawlowski.
Madam Chair, again, this is Michael Pawlowski with the Department of Revenue. Just to supplement, one of the things that we've heard consistently through testimony, beginning in the TAPS Throughput Committee, is the impact of the high cost of doing business in Alaska on the oil industry. And in that we have a net tax system, there is a relationship between a vibrant service industry and support industry to a healthy oil business. And one of the attempts, I think, here in this amendment is to increase the health of that sector and hopefully drive down costs. So as we continue to evaluate this idea and work it through the system, putting some thought into the relationship between the ultimate revenues that the state gets from more profitable projects is something that we need to consider as well. But it was really geared towards oil and gas specific property, and I just thought it important to put that back on the record, that this is not a broad universe of manufacturing, but in that the state has a profits-based tax, the less expensive the property that goes into the cost equation actually does have a feedback loop to the revenues for the state.
Thank you. Senator Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pawlowski, I believe this is defined somewhere in code, but manufacturing isn't having a product and adding a feather to it, or in the oil industry, a bolt, that we actually have a threshold that speaks to manufacturing. So if we could just clarify that for the general public.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I'd point you to page 3, line 10, where we define manufacturing, and that means to perform substantial industrial operations in the state to transform raw material into tangible personal property with a useful life of 3 years or more for use in the exploration, development, and production of oil and gas, regardless of whether the oil and gas is located in state. So that makes it the capital item that's manufactured. Line 14, the modification, means an adjustment, equipping, or other alteration to existing tangible personal property that has a useful life of 3 years or more and is for use in the exploration, development, production of oil and gas reserves.
And Madam Chair, to follow up, this is Mike Pawlowski, and the important caveat in that section is on page 3, line 17, that modification does not include minor product alterations or inventory activities. And we will continue to work with the committee and the legislature going forward as this concept that was started in TAPS Throughput is continued to be refined.
Senator Faircloth, follow up.
Thank you. Two more questions. Have you consulted oil industry or some kind of manufacturing somewhere to think about what that product might be, and could you give me an example of that? And then the second question is, why did you choose $10 million?
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, I had some initial conversations, but I do look forward to hearing from the service sector to see what this would mean to them. But it seemed like they thought this would be beneficial to their businesses and promoting business growth in the state of Alaska. The $10 million cap is it's a threshold level at this point. Again, it's we don't know. We're hoping this will be a boom, but until we see exactly what happens and as this works through the process, that could certainly be a discussion point.
And Senator Faircloth, through the chair, if I might add, this is Mike Pawlowski again. The choosing of the $10 million was to be judicious. I mean, sincere intent in the bill overall is to protect the state treasury and the ongoing obligations to the state. And you heard testimony from PFC that when there are credits, often the transferability of credits to be used against a tax liability is a viable mechanism to provide some protection for the state. So the goal was to work through to the extent possible to encourage some of those activities that don't have to happen in Alaska. Drilling for oil in Alaska, you have to do from Alaska. But doing a module, coating pipes, those type of real industrial activities, fabrication, that doesn't necessarily have to happen in Alaska. And that, again, going back to the principle of a vibrant support industry is critical to a healthy oil and gas sector. to try and start to poke at that problem, and again, recognizing the benefit it might have to a net profit system overall.
Very good. Senator Bishop, I believe you had a question, am I correct?
Comment.
Thank you.
I'd like to dovetail on with what Mike said and to help maybe further follow up with Senator Fairclough's question. You talked about, I mean, and Senator Dyson and I, you know, we've both been on the slope, and modules came in on sea lifts. Of course, now we couldn't manufacture a module in the state in those days to do that, but we want to make Alaska competitive. Well, this is another way to do that. The independents, I think, you know, the majors are the anchor, the independents are the future. And if we can expand that module fabrication business, because I think there's going to be a lot of, could be a fair amount of truckable modules that come up the highway. They could be manufactured on the peninsula, south central, interior. Okay, so there's another manufacturing in the state, and instrumentation is an equally important part. And I know Senator Bercicchi knows a whole lot about instrumentation and how important that is to the oil and gas business. And we've got instrumentation business here in the state. And the more we can do to improve our goods and services, because we want to be competitive, because we've heard for weeks now how our labor costs are high, our manufacturing costs are high. So it's volume. The more you can do here, the cheaper you can do it. And it's jobs that stay here in Alaska. So that's just a little thumbnail sketch. Thank you.
Great comments. Thank you. Any further questions for Mr. Pawlowski or Mr. Tangeman? All right. Thank you very much. That summarizes the ideas that the committee has put forth as we worked through this bill, and has come from the TAPS Throughput Committee, which I really appreciate that letter of intent they sent forward. We have some additional amendments that have been offered. As committee members know, I've mentioned it here on the record, amendments were asked for earlier this week. There are some additional amendments that have not been included in the CS thus far. Senator French is not here today to offer them, so we will be hearing those amendments on Monday. I've also will be asking producers and explorers to come to the table again to comment on these possible changes. So we'll be hearing from them on Monday. And in the meantime, I really appreciate all the great discussion today on this CS as we've put it forth. It's a working document. We'll be refining it, and committee members have asked some great questions. So at this time, we'll adjourn. We'll meet again on Monday at 3:30. And the time is 5. Pardon me.
I apologize, Madam Chair. The amendments appear to be written to the original document. Is that correct?
Thank you, Senator Fairclough. I believe Ms. Long, are you here to speak to that? No. Okay.
No, but
go on, please, Senator Fairclough.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure that Senator French, if he's out of ear range right now, make sure that his staff know that the amendments should be retooled to the CS so that they can be offered properly. I don't want him to, in his absence, not to have the appropriate notification that a CS is on the table. I'm sure his staff knows, but I just want to make I see his staff now. Just want to make sure that it goes to the CS.
The discussion has already taken place with his staff before the meeting even convened. At this point, I'm going to remove my objection to the bill. And Ms. Long, do you have any closing remarks?
No, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll continue the work on this bill at our next meeting then. So we will adjourn at this time. The time is 5:19 p.m. Committee stands in adjournment.